Arte da ascoltare. Radio Papesse al Festival dell'Arte Contemporanea. Lynn Cook, invitata a Faenza a parlare di mostre e pratiche curatoriali, sta lavorando tra New York e Madrid due mostre, una retrospettiva di Blinky Palermo e una collettiva dal titolo Mixed Use Manhattan. L'abbiamo incontrata a Faenza e abbiamo parlato di contemporaneità artistica, del format retrospettiva, delle sue implicazioni in ambito curatoriale e artistico, di ambizione e modestia. Ci presenta infine Mixed Use, di prossima apertura a Reina Sofia di Madrid. Una mostra che, da una parte, espone progetti e lavori di quegli artisti che negli anni della deindustrializzazione e della distruzione pianificata del Lower Manhattan hanno lavorato con e nella città, nei suoi spazi negletti e abbandonati. Dall'altra, documenta i risultati delle ricerche più attuali di quegli artisti che credono ancora nelle possibilità estetiche di New York.
For me, if we're talking about contemporary art, I guess I'm thinking of artists who came to maturity in the mid-60s and younger, so the generation of the minimalists, the arte povera, conceptual artists, most of whom are still alive and working, and the subsequent generations. That comprises contemporary art for me. For many art historians, modern art begins with Manet, some with Courbet, some with Demoiselle d'Avignon in 1906, but I think the first 60 or so years of the 20th century are a period that's distinct from practices today. Abstract expressionism is the end of something to me. It's a combination of interests and issues that have recurred over and over in the 20th century. There's something fundamentally different in the understanding of art and its place in the world once you get to Lawrence Wiener or even Gerhard Richter. Retrospective's becoming a more problematic idea, I think, than it was, say, 30 years ago. The idea of retrospectives is a 20th century thing to begin with. It's relatively recent. It obviously didn't go on in the Renaissance or Baroque. It worked well for artists who made easel paintings or even big paintings, artists who made objects, sculptures, like Brancusi or Derain or any surrealist, Magritte. You can gather these together, you can put them in chronological order, you can pull out strands and threads, and that's normally what we understand by a retrospective. And then you can do that with hindsight to artists from the past, Turner, even going further back to Caravaggio and so on. This is a kind of classic or canonical retrospective. But, for example, once you get to an artist like Walter de Maria, where the key works are works in the land or were ephemeral gestures that don't exist now, it doesn't function in the same way. And I think it raises the question, really, is every artist best served by a retrospective in this classical, canonical sense? And some, like Thomas Schutte, I've just done this retrospective, are, and others are not. And it's not something, it's not an evaluation, it's really a description of what the practices are and how one can begin to get a larger sense of them. So for example, I've also just done a project with Pierre Huyghe, and I know Pierre would hate the idea of retrospective, but it also really wouldn't make sense, at least not at this point in his professional life. It's often a summing up. And just logistically, it can take two. If a retrospective travels to three different venues, the amount of time in organization and then reinstalling and all that goes with it can take 2 years out of an artist's life. And that's a very big break. It means looking backwards. And somehow the artist is, whether he or she really wants to, obliged to reconsider what they've done, and in doing so, come to terms with the past at a moment that maybe isn't a good moment to try summing things up. So I think even for the artists for whom retrospectives are easily possible, timing is a critical issue. From examples in the past, mid-career retrospectives, mid-career surveys, can actually have a negative effect both in critical terms, but also, as you say, psychologically, in the life cycle of the artist. Well, there's no such thing as an objective presentation. It's always an interpretation. It's always authored to some degree. And then there's the question of how much exchange with the artist. Some artists really have a very strong version or view of what they want to do. And others say, you do it, and I'm stepping out of the picture. But these are only two factors. Then there's the question of the context, and that's the physical context, the museum, the kinds of spaces, the scale of it, and then the audience and what is known of the artist already and what are the general ideas about that artist, because some retrospectives can set out to really critically re-examine and provide a new model for thinking about the artist, and others are just more like summaries. So I think retrospectives vary in type a lot. And they vary in goal. They serve different ends for different artists in different contexts. And for me, the context is really critical. But the nature of the intellectual cultural context, it's different to make a retrospective in New York from in Madrid. It's different to make a retrospective of a 40-year-old artist from a 70-year-old artist. There are many factors. I think it's made out of a relationship, and there has to be a certain amount of trust. You can't work at loggerheads in opposition to someone. It's a totally fatal and terrible situation. Also, I think the curator is the interface. The curator's in the middle between the artist and between the institution. The curator who works for the institution, not a guest curator. Because the curator has to argue on the artist's behalf against the institution sometimes. And on the other hand, the curator has sometimes to represent the institution to the artist in order to, you know, for issues of health and safety with work. And there are, to take one example. So the curator needs to be Jaina's face to turn in both directions, different moments. For me, I always work with people I have a relationship with. And that doesn't mean I work with my friends. It means that if I get very interested in artist work, I will go to shows, I will do studio visits long before I invite them to do something. I already have some experience of having how to talk to them, some shared moments, coffee, discussions. So there's something to build on. I would never start completely fresh with someone. It's just, I don't see that it's going to be the most productive way to work. I would hope less about compromise and more about negotiation, because I think it's not about finding something that neither party wants but each has to agree to. It's more about finding a solution that one person wants and the others can come to see works. So it's a matter of going back and forth, and sometimes it goes in one direction and sometimes in the other. But I think it's really about juggling and trying to evaluate which really are the primary concerns and whose needs have to be prioritized here. Whereas compromise often suggests you find a common ground that nobody really wanted, but that's where you end up. I think there are a number of factors. Institutional critique certainly articulated a lot of issues about how institutions function, about the different relations and power relations and the needs of audiences and questions of translation, all of those things. But that happens simultaneously with the professionalization of curators, the growth in the concern with pedagogy and education and audiences, the growth in public relations, this widespread or growing interest in contemporary art, not just by knowledgeable people, but by the culture at large for many different reasons, and people wanting many different things out of museums and look at exhibitions. So all of that together, I think, has really changed the conscious levels of understanding. I'm not sure that when Harold Zeman was making a show in Zurich or Basel in 1970, those issues were still there, but they weren't talked about in the same way, and some things were different. Audiences were not given as much attention, perhaps. It wasn't felt so necessary to bring people to look at contemporary art. They could find it if they wanted, but you didn't have to reach out in the same way. But in some senses, those are the other aspects have always been there. Well, we live in a global world. That's a cliche, but we see that in terms of how there are many more countries, there are many more parts of the world in which contemporary art is practiced in a way that's similar to the North American, Western Europe axis. That's true, and sometimes I think it's misleading because local issues are still very, they always shape and frame things. So that changes, and I think the magnitude of the art world means that a whole generation of artists have made work and careers out of biennales and large-scale exhibitions and public commissions and residencies and not working through a market. That's a different kind of practice, but it's very possible now. So there are certain things that are different and artists' ambitions are different. I think, though, the idea of working outside the market, which supposedly was a factor in the late 60s, I think that was a misunderstanding. Walter de Maria did not want to go and make land art work because he was trying to work outside the market. That was not a consideration. He always showed in galleries, just to take one case. And I think in practice, what we see is most artists find a way of working centrally or peripherally with the market, or with gallerists who work like agents, or so that not every gallery operates in the same way. Some galleries are barely present physically, but they still work with artists. Some artists make very little that could be shown in a gallery, but they still make works for sale. So there's a much broader spectrum of activity, but I think that the market's a factor, so is the public arena, and so artists' ambitions are somehow threaded through both still. I'm a little ambivalent about huge ambitious projects. I mean, looking back in the end of the 60s, early the 70s, those projects look huge. But when you look at actually how much it costs to make the Spiral Jetty, in today's terms, it wasn't really a lot of money. It was an ambition, it was an intense determination, but it wasn't millions of dollars. And we look at projects today which literally do cost millions of dollars. And not every artist benefits from a lot of resources. And we also see artists who've made enough money to do things on a grander scale, and it's not necessarily been highly productive. So yes, of course, there are wonderful big projects, but some of the best pieces are modest still. Modest physically or modest in resources. There's Francis Elise's project, the one where about how faith moves a mountain, where he has 600 people in t-shirts digging in sand dunes in Peru. It's a lot of organization. It wasn't a huge amount of money. It was seen by very few people. It's known about by a vast number because of the conduits, the documentation, rumor, discussion, film. And for me, that's a great project in recent years. And as public as any, it's had many different interpretations. It's extremely rich in intellectual and conceptual terms, but it wasn't necessarily a hugely expensive project. So I think these things can be done in different ways. And this grew out of an invitation to participate in a biennale, and a very poor biennale at that. Mixed use is a term used by developers or real estate people in New York City, and it means that a building has been zoned that allows commercial activity and residential. And it came about in the late 60s with the financial crisis, end of manufacturing pretty well in New York City, the deindustrialization of the city. Lots of artists moved into loft buildings in Soho and Tribeca and squatted. So they had studios there, but they lived there, and living was illegal. And in the around 75, the state of New York legislated to change that, to give artists who'd been living occupying the same premises for a long time, rights as legal tenants, and the term mixed use came into operation. It can also mean a neighborhood where there's commercial manufacturing, businesses of different kinds, and people living. It really was a term that came in after the fact to describe a change that wasn't gentrification. It was actually simply just shifts in ways of operating and living in this neighborhood. And gentrification came later, but that wasn't the point. And the show, it starts at that moment when New York sees this crisis, financial, manufacturing, industrial, and artists take to the streets, literally, and begin working in the streets, in the abandoned wharves and piers, on the rooftops of buildings, and they make their own work, not because they won't show in galleries, but in addition to, or as alternatives to, or in dialogue with, in parallel. And this is many artists, some of performance artists who work with camera or work with colleagues who have, so it's film, photography, video, sound art, and so on. But it intersects with another kind of flânerie, if you like, another kind of way of using the street, which was a gay scene and cruising. And there's a very strong moment in the gay scene in downtown Manhattan in the 70s, around the piers, around the West Side Highway, and some of the artists were involved in both. A photographer like Peter Hooja was very involved in the gay scene, but photographed not just that, but through the city, Alvin Baltrop and others. So it takes all these different kinds of activity and looks at them. It puts borders around it. So, for example, it's not the club scene. It's not the East Village club scene. It's not the subcultures of Nan Golden and her friends. It's a particular moment in public where the camera plays a very big role. These images made as artworks. For example, some artists doing performance hired professional photographers, like a man called Peter Moore is very famous for the photographs he took of Trisha Brown, and others worked with people who photographed who were artists. And we're interested not in documentation, we're interested in artworks. And it's a fine line, but Peter Hooja or Alvin Baltrop, who was less successful as a photographer, Hooja is a celebrated photographer. William Gedney, Ben Arguillo, Thomas Struth was in New York for a year. He was photographing the city. Cindy Sherman made the film stills down in this part of the city. They were made as works of art in the widest sense. If you take photography, photography for galleries, photography for museums, that kind of photograph, it's that kind of work. And it's not snapshots on the street. It's not William Klein's street scenes. Yes, it's specific in that it's about works of art and only includes works of art. That could be one thread to look at, certainly, but another would be architectural photography, like Atche. If you think of all the documentation of Paris that Atche did in the turn of the 20th century, and of course other people were documenting too, but we look at Atche as an artist, and we don't look at all the others in the same terms. You could say Thomas Struth and Banton Hiller Becker follow in that tradition, and the Beckers, of course, are in this. Or you could say there's the tradition of walking and photographing, and so there's work by someone who's not known as a photographer. Two people who are not. One is Stefan Brecht, who is Bertolt Brecht's son. He's best known as a writer on alternative theatre and a poet. But at one moment, he decided to photograph the journey he took every day from the West Village to Chelsea Hotel, where he was writing, to make a book that combined photographs of the pavements with the poetry he was writing. And so there are photographs and poems that go on top of each other. The book was never published, but we will include this because it's absolutely what you're saying about walking and photographing. There's another suite of photographs taken by Sol LeWitt, who didn't take a lot of photographs, but he made some very particular projects with a camera. And one is of brick walls in the city of around the Lower East Side where he lived. Well, if I think about Richard's work, it's like two things he sees suddenly and he realizes the humor or the improbability or the wit or the bizarreness. And you, by taking the photograph, he makes us see them really differently. And it's not just photographs in his case, but it's often through photography. In this show, the person who's closest to that, looking at the minutiae of the street or the discarded or the worthless and finding value, it would be Gabriel Orozco. And there are some of Orozco's photographs of New York, just tiny things. A puddle on the street with the light falling in a certain way. It's exactly that. As the city's become gentrified, all of Manhattan practically, it's changed in 30 years, it's changed enormously. There's much less public space. Dan Graham has talked about this a lot, how atriums have been built in on the streets, but some people are allowed in, others are not, or they're made to feel they're not allowed in. There are very few public parks that don't have fences and guards and surveillance, and this public space is a different thing from what it was. And a number of artists would say you have to contest this. You have to really reoccupy it, take it back on your terms rather than the terms of corporations, institutional authority, and so on. And an artist like Sharon Hayes, who's in this show, her work is all about that. It's all about how reviving protests, reprising actions that were about the occupancy of space by different people with different goals and values. The best case is Times Square and the cleaning up of Times Square. What that did really mean is big developers came in. It's all oriented to tourists or to expensive restaurants and theaters. And what had been there were pawn shops, sex clubs, theaters, panhandlers, office workers, local people who lived there, bars and so on. But an incredible mix. And it wasn't necessarily always the safest place, nor the prettiest place, but it had a very dynamic, really dynamic mix of people, and it was intensely used. The famous book by Samuel Delaney called Times Square Red, Times Square Blue, and it's about the life of people there, both as someone who frequented it and also in a more sociological sense. And you go there now, and it's monopolized by corporations. It could be in many places in the world. It could be a moment in Shanghai, it could be a moment in Berlin. It's lost all its texture and specificity and above all history. It's a loss, in my view. So much of this development of public space often comes with the loss of something.
Radio papesse.org